Last time we talked about the role of prophets to the Old Testament people of Israel, and not in the sense of future telling, but saying this is what God is revealing to you now. And so we talked briefly about the major versus the minor prophets. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel would be considered the four major prophets, and we have 12 minor prophets. And again, it's not so much that one has more important things to say, just four of them had longer sections devoted to them in the Jewish Bible. So we looked at Isaiah last time as an example of one prophet. We're going to skip Jeremiah again, not because there's nothing there, but just a matter of time, so we're going to keep moving. I thought we'd look at Ezekiel, Daniel, and maybe get Jonah in here as well. So let's look at the book of Ezekiel to start off with. Again, just like Isaiah, Ezekiel has visions. And it says he is over there as part of the exiles in Babylon. It says in chapter 1, verse 1, the heavens were opened and I saw visions of God. And then we get this tremendously odd vision, the four living creatures, and they appear to pop up again in Revelation. By the way, we will talk about Revelation, but I might just mention now that so much of Revelation seems to puzzle people, but a lot of it, something like three quarters of it, is just taken right out of Old Testament parts. So there's really nothing all that strange. John in Revelation was using a lot of the basic material that he knew Jewish people would understand. All right, so we have these creatures, and then here comes some sort of odd divine chariot, but people have had a lot of fun with this. Chapter 1, verse 15, he sees a wheel on the ground besides these creatures there. And it says they had structure of the wheels, and then they had wheels intersecting wheels, and they moved all these different ways, and they made the sounds as like roaring of rushing waters down in verse 24. And the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. There have been some people who've tried to suggest flying saucers, UFOs, that Ezekiel had this vision of a UFO and didn't really know how to describe it and did it in terms that he would understand, which is chariots. Now, I think we can probably see this as more of an example of all-seeing God with his creatures that are otherworldly, and the omnipotence of God, the tremendous power of God here. And it says he has a radiance in verse 28 around him, and this was the glory of Yahweh. And he says at the end of chapter 1, when I saw it, I fell face down. Remember, Isaiah says, woe unto me, I'm a man of unclean lips. And so God speaks to him and says, stand up. In chapter 2, and he hears Ezekiel's call, and this sounds exactly like the role of prophets that we talked about last time. If we look at verse 3, chapter 2, he says, son of man, I am sending you to the Israelites. Verse 4, say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. So the prophet never goes in his own power, never goes with his own personal message, but comes to these people and tells them what God has told him. So he's the mouthpiece of God here, and says, don't be afraid. And then chapter 3, here comes something that we're going to encounter several places. I skipped over it in Isaiah. I think I may have mentioned it, that many times these prophets were asked to do something physical as an object lesson to demonstrate to the people of Israel something of the supernatural world, something symbolic to represent God's interaction with his people. And so in this case, he has to eat a scroll and then go speak to the house of Israel. And Hosea, for example, a minor prophet, had to marry a prostitute. And that was supposed to represent the way God wanted a relationship with his people, but his people kept going after other gods, committing adultery in a sense. God was the groom who wanted this woman and loved her greatly, but she sought other gods and went drifting off. And so Hosea has to go through that. Isaiah had to walk around with just a loincloth, representing how the people were going to be stripped of all that they thought was useful. Ezekiel here has the symbolism of eating the scroll, but I wanted to show you, especially if you look at chapter 4, here's the ultimate of symbolism going on. Chapter 4, verse 1, take a clay tablet, put it in front of you and draw the city of Jerusalem, then lay siege to it, erect siege works, build a ramp, set up camps. Then take an iron pan, place it as an iron wall between you and the city, and turn your face toward it. It will be under siege, and you... So here, Ezekiel is forced to demonstrate what's going to happen to Israel. Let's go back. Verse 4, you have to lie on one side for 390 days, so for over a year. Verse 6... you turn your, after you do this, lie down again, this time on your right side. You do that for 40 days, a day for each year. And then you get tied up with ropes in verse 8. Verse 9, you make bread, you have to eat the bread. And it goes on and it goes on. There's one little bit of humor here. They have to use, according to verse 12, Ezekiel is to make this food, and he has to use human excrement for food to show how distasteful the people of Israel are to God and what's going to happen to them as they're driven out and how low they will get where they have to eat that way. And at that point, Ezekiel is, okay. So he's doing all these things, but at verse 14, he says to God, that's it. Not so, Sovereign Lord. I've never defiled myself. I've never eaten anything found dead or torn by wild animals. No unclean meat's ever entered my mouth. So God says, all right, you can use cow manure instead of human excrement. But that struck me as funny. He's willing to go through a certain number of unpleasant things for God, but he draws the line at cooking with human excrement. I want to take you after some of this introductory material. By the way, there are prophecies, as you would expect, against other nations. And I would like to take you to 37, chapter 37. I want you to see this vision. By the way, supposedly young people were not allowed in ancient times to read Ezekiel until they reached a certain age because there was so much odd stuff happening here. It might have given them nightmares. I would suggest this is something right out of a science fiction movie or a horror movie, I guess. It says in chapter 37 of Ezekiel, he is brought out by the Spirit of the Lord and set in the middle of a valley full of bones. And they're just all these bones, and they're dry. And so he is asked a question by God, pretty obvious question. Can these bones live? Well, it doesn't look like it. They're just dusty, desiccated bones sitting there. And then verse 5, this is what the Sovereign Lord says to these bones. I will make breath enter you, and you will come to life. So this is, in a sense, a prophecy for the land itself, for the Israelites who appear to be dead and gone. They've been hauled off into captivity, but God is God and he can do whatever he wants, and he will someday resurrect these people. And so we're going to get a resurrection story here. Verse 6, I will attach tendons to you and make flesh come upon you and cover you with skin. I will put breath in you and you will come to life. Then you'll know that I am the Lord. And sure enough, Ezekiel prophesies this and says there was a noise in verse 7, a rattling sound, and the bones came together, bone to bone, tendons and flesh appeared on them, skin covered them, but there was no breath in them yet. But God brings breath, and then they come in verse 10, they come to life and stand on their feet, a vast army. So you might think of this almost zombie-like, but they're coming back to life. But can you imagine this? I think the closest thing would be maybe the first Mummy movie, where this man from ancient Egypt comes alive, but it takes him a while. The pieces of him are not quite back together yet, and we see these gaping parts of his skin and covered with some flesh, and finally he's restored again, but it's pretty gross to look at. And so the story behind this in verse 11, these bones are the whole house of Israel, and eventually the people will be brought back to the land. Of course, in 1948, Israel was finally restored to the land, and a lot of people were excited to see that as interpreted that event as a fulfillment of this prophecy here in chapter 37. Of course, if you want to continue, chapters 38, 39 talk about places called Gog and Magog and Meshach and Tubal, And there are a lot of references to that. People that study prophecy and write these tempestuous books about the end times, and they get a lot of following, and a lot of people read these. And they will take the references to Gog and connect it to Russia and talk about a resurrection of the Russian Empire coming against Israel. So you can take a look, see what you think. Apparently some tremendous warfare going on. So that's Ezekiel, one more of the major prophets. Let's do Daniel as well. I think we have enough time here. Daniel also taken off into captivity. This is a very strange book. We will come back to it again, talk about it later, but Daniel has six chapters which are stories, and you know some of those stories, I'm sure, images of worship that three of the children of Israel refuse to worship and they're thrown into it, the fiery furnace story. We get Daniel in the lion's den. We get the famous writing on the wall with Belshazzar. And these are interesting episodic stories, but since we're talking about prophets and prophecy, let's look at the second half of the book, starting in chapter 7. Daniel has dreams, he has interpretations, he has visions. And I will skip over those except to say that there's a tremendous debate that rages regarding the dating of Daniel, because it seems to be so clear, especially in chapter 8, referencing Persia and Greece, the goat being Greece, and this prominent goat that comes and does certain things references Alexander the Great, apparently, and seems to follow his life pretty well. And so you can look at that if you want. I have just heard that there's enough physical evidence as far as the kinds of words being used, the way the language is put together, to actually date Daniel several hundred years previous to these episodes here. But some people say, no, this is prophesying done after the act. In other words, he lived during this time and was able to write it as if it's prophecy when he already knows what happened. But very interesting material there. I do want to go to one chapter in Daniel, which strikes me as maybe the most interesting of them all, regarding the prophecies that Daniel has. Okay, I want to take you to chapter 9. We get this famous part called the 77s. And I want to take you to verse 24 and have us look at that. This is Daniel. This is one of his prophecies. And this is a future prophecy. 77s are decreed for your people in your holy city to finish transgression. So, of course, the big debate right there is, what does he mean, 77s? There's some kind of time period here. People generally have interpreted the 7 as a span of 7 years. And if that was the case, then Daniel says 490 years, which would be 70 times 7, 490 years are decreed for your people to finish their transgression. And remember, they're in bondage, they're in Babylon as this is being written. Let's go to verse 25. He's going to use a time frame here, and he starts it with a particular event. He says, from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, we would say the Messiah, the ruler comes, there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. It will be rebuilt. The it would be Jerusalem, obviously, rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble. After the 62 sevens, the anointed one will be cut off and will have nothing. The people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end will come like a flood. And then verse 27, he, this is that ruler who will come, will confirm a covenant with many for 1 7. In the middle of the 7, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. Now, some people interpret that as Antiochus Epiphanes, who came from the Syria area and attacked the people. But here's the way I have heard it described, and it gets pretty interesting. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, that was verse 25, until the anointed one comes, there's going to be a time period that goes by. So let's think about that for a minute. The issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, that's covered in Nehemiah. There was a decree issued in 445 BC that would allow some of the children who wished to go back to Israel, to the land, and rebuild Jerusalem. And so the story of Ezra and Nehemiah tells the story of these people coming back and attempting to rebuild their city and their land that had been just totally decimated by the Babylonians sometime before then. So it says, from that decree, so the clock starts ticking, until the Anointed One comes, there's going to be this time period. And if you multiply it out, those 62 sevens and all, you'll get over 400 years. And that puts you about the time of Jesus. And then it says in verse 26, after these 62 sevens, so after this time period, the Anointed One will be cut off and will have nothing. Well, that's odd, isn't it? You think of the Anointed One, the one that's going to come as the ruler, but apparently the Anointed One comes, according to this, and is cut off somehow. Christians are going to look at that and say, that was Jesus. And then it says, the people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. So when was Jerusalem attacked again? 70 AD by the Romans after the time of Jesus, and they came and just took one stone, just ripped it from the next, and ruined this beautiful temple that Herod had rebuilt. But I just wanted you to think about that and look at that and consider from what other people have said. It's interesting, however you interpret that. So that's and a lot of information here, a lot of historical information of this ruler, Antiochus Epiphanes, in roughly the 180s BC, who came into the land and put up a statue for people to worship called the Abomination of Desolation. And that's picked up, obviously, when Jesus talks about a future abomination. Revelation picks up on this. So this is a very powerful section. There's also a reference Daniel has in here to somebody called the Son of Man. And Jesus picks up on that as well. So much of Daniel is going to resonate into the New Testament. So I just wanted you to think about that. Much focus on Gentiles in Daniel. I think that's one reason it resonates with New Testament as they spread the word of Jesus out into the Gentile world. Okay, I want to do, we still have enough time. Let's do Jonah. One last prophet, and I saved this one for last, not only because it's a smaller book and we're moving through the Old Testament, but it acts as a great contrast to what we've just been hearing about. We had Isaiah, we had Ezekiel, we had Daniel. All these people stood up under tremendous pressure. Jeremiah, the same thing. They were persecuted. Go back to Elijah. They were always persecuted by the kings because they did not give them the information they wanted. They came and challenged the status quo. They told the people they were messing up. Nobody wants to hear that. So there was great controversy when these prophets showed up, and they suffered physically, big time. Now, think about those people standing up for their faith, saying, it doesn't matter, this is what God's told me to do. And then let's compare that to the book of Jonah. What is Jonah here? Well, it doesn't take us long to see a very different sort of prophet show up. Chapter 1, verse 1, the word of the Lord comes to Jonah, go to Nineveh and preach against it. Well, Nineveh, let's think about that for a second. Capital of Syria. What was Assyria? Maybe one of the harshest regimes that's ever existed. They make Al-Qaeda look like kindergarten cops. These were horrific people that did awful things to the ones that they captured. And, of course, their use of intimidation and fear often kept them from having to attack a city because people were so terrified when they showed up. So it's true, Jonah was up to a huge task here, right? He was told, go to Nineveh and preach against it. But we know how prophets react. We know what he's going to say. Prophets stand up and say, God's with me. Who can be against me? It doesn't matter. And they march forth. Well, verse 3, Jonah ran away and headed for Tarshish, Spain, basically. So what does he do? He's told, go east. And what does he do instead? He goes west. So it's not just a case of, oh, I'll get there eventually. He goes the exact opposite direction. And of course, we know the story. He gets on a ship. There's a storm that comes up. They figure out it's Jonah's fault. He says, yeah, I did things wrong, I know it's my fault. Tossed in the water, great fish, swallows him, spews him out onto dry ground, and he's got to go to Nineveh. Okay, so he goes, not happily, but he goes. Now, I want you to think about what's going on in chapter 3. Use your imagination here. Chapter 3, verse 3. So after all of this, God says, do it. Go tell those people. Give them a chance. Warn them. Turn or burn, as they say. Repent or trouble's coming to you. So Jonah obeys the word of the Lord and went to Nineveh. Now on the first day there, verse 4, chapter 3, Jonah comes in. This is it. He has one sentence. Now think about, we had Isaiah, we have Jeremiah, we have Ezekiel, we have Daniel. They take pages and pages to read through. They're eloquent. Their visions are powerful. And what does Jonah do? How powerful is this? It's a single sentence. 40 more days and Nineveh will be overturned. That's the end of the quote. Here's my idea. Here's the way I imagine it. We try to recreate this. Jonah goes trudging up to the city gates, not happy to be there. Frankly, he doesn't want the people to turn anyway. He doesn't want them to come around. He'd love to see lightning come down to smack that city. So he goes trudging up there and he says, where's your main center for expressing yourself in front of the rulers and the elite? Oh, it's over there. Okay. So he walks over there. And that's it, one sentence. And I picture him saying this in a monotone. He doesn't want these people really to react and think about it. So I picture a toneless 40 more days and Nineveh will be overturned. Thank you very much. I'm done. I've done my job. See God. These people are they'll never turn. And he spins around, heads out as fast as he can. But verse 5 says, the Ninevites believed God and they immediately declare a fast and put on sackcloth. The king covers himself, sits in the dust, covers himself with sackcloth. Let everybody call on God. And what's interesting, I guess there are some stories that that people recorded times that Nineveh and Assyria did repent and did things like this. So it wasn't unheard of, but of course they went right back to their ways. But God has compassion on them. And doesn't bring on them, it says at the end of chapter 3, doesn't bring the destruction that he had threatened. Well, again, think about a typical prophet. First of all, he ran away. Secondly, Jonah was different because he gave a message as quickly as possible, not full of power and emotion. And then third, a normal prophet would have said, well, thank you, God, for sparing these people. What a wonderful God I serve. But what does Jonah say in chapter 4? How does he feel? He was displeased. He became angry. And can you hear his language when he speaks? Can you hear the whine in his voice? Verse 2. O Lord, is this not what I said when I was still at home? This is why I was so quick to flee to Tarshish. I knew that you're a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from sin and calamity. Now, O Lord, take away my life, for it's better for me to die than to live. And he goes and he sits out at the edge of the city. He is so upset, waiting for that lightning strike, waiting for the city to catch fire. And it doesn't. And almost like the book of Job, God gets the last word, and we don't hear any more from Jonah. Verse 10 says, you've been concerned about this vine. In verse 11, he said, but Nineveh, let's compare it here, has more than 120,000 people who can't tell their right hand from their left, and many cattle as well. Should I not be concerned about that great city? So God is willing to reach beyond his own people. I think that's a message as well, that He's turning from just the chosen people, and he has concern for all of them. So, quite a story here. I find that fascinating. We might think of Nineveh as being a symbol of the Gentiles here, that God is willing for his prophets to move beyond their comfort zone, go out into the world, take this message with you, even to groups of people you really don't like, you find them distasteful. All right, so there's a look at another prophet. So we've done Isaiah, we've done Ezekiel, we've taken a look at Daniel, and we've ended up with the anti-prophet Jonah. Next time we'll move to the New Testament. We'll look at Jesus, the impact of Christianity. Take a look at the book of Luke. I think it's my favorite gospel. We'll talk more about why, but I think it's the most accessible of all the Gospels for people today in the 21st century.